The poem you have on the handout is from the Tiruvai Moli, which is a collection of poems by Namalvar, or as he's known by his Sanskrit name, Shatakopan. Namalvar is the title essentially he got, but it means our Alvar, the Alvar that belongs to us. And it's a title that he received because he's the most popular of all the Alvars. And if you remember, the Alvars are these Tamil saints who Ramanuja incorporates into his own tradition, who wrote poems, who lived in the centuries before Ramanuja, and who wrote poems in praise of Vishnu, but specifically Vishnu as he's manifested in various temples, mostly in the Tamil region. And so the poem you have here is one of his. It's quite typical for the way he writes. And anyway, let's start with that. So it describes the holy place called Tiru Tolai Vili Mangalam, or Tolai Vili Mangalam, which is a place in the Tamil region. It's a Tamil name, where there is a shrine to Vishnu. And it describes, as we will see, a group of pilgrims that goes to that temple for worship, and something happens to one of the pilgrims as she arrives there. And it's the poem is a description of her. So she worships lofty Tirutolai Vili Mangalam, this place, with its great houses, flawless jewels. So leave her alone, women, have no hopes regarding her. She cries, the bright radiance conch and discus, she cries, the wide lotus eyes. She keeps standing there, tears welling in her radiant Kuvalai flower eyes. She bursts. So the conch and the discus are two of the things that Vishnu holds in two of his arms. So he's always depicted with four arms. And conch and disc are two things he holds. And lotus eyes is a very common image in Sanskrit and Tamil literature. It's basically beautiful eyes. So she, it's about the image that's there in the temple at Tirutolai Vili Mangalam. She has entered Tirutolai Vili Mangalam, noisy with the deep din of festivals. So have no hopes regarding her, this girl with her sweet nectar words. Transformed, she stands speechless, crying, Lord, God of gods, her mouth twisting this way and that, her eyes welling tears. She bends, she breaks, she comes apart. This girl with her sweet poetic words has entered Tirutolai Vili Mangalam with its cool panai trees and green groves on river banks. So have no hopes regarding her. Tears flowing from her slender eyes, she raves about how he lay upon the waves of the sea, measured the whole earth, herded the cows. So Vishnu lay upon the waves of the sea. This is the form of Vishnu who lies on the ocean, on the snake Ananta. He measured the whole earth. This is Vamana, who appeared as a dwarf to take to ask for the king of the Asuras for three steps of land, and then with his three steps took over the entire world and herded the cows. This is a reference to Krishna, who lived in a pastoral setting and herded cows. After seeing Tirutolai Vili Mangalam, where people prosperous in the abiding four Vedas dwell, she's lost all self-controls. See, she's beyond you, women. She cries, Lord Kanan, dark as the sea is everything that can be learned. So this is Vishnu, whose complexion is dark, like the sea. She has no modesty left. She keeps rejoicing, delighted within. She melts away. The poor thing, she melts, her face shines, for after entering Tirutolai Vili Mangalam, you showed her the Lord with the red lotus eyes, the splendid light. Starting then, her eyes have rained like clouds. She's amazed, women. Her mind has gone inside there. She keeps on looking in that direction, in the direction of the temple, worshipping. Everywhere you see sugar cane, tall ripening paddy, and luxuriant red lotuses at rich Tirutolai Vili Mangalam, on the north bank of the cool Porunal, which is the river. After seeing this, she looks nowhere but that direction, all day, every day. And the only word in her mouth is the name of the jewel-colored one, Vishnu, O women. Women, this great lovely peahen, this little doe, has escaped our hands. Whatever you say, she hears nothing but tolai vilimangalam. Is this the outcome of things she did before, or the magic of the cloud-colored Lord? All she wants is to learn his signs, his names. She worshipped Tirutolai Vilimangalam on the northern bank of the Porunal, where the perfect Vedas and sacrifices and great women mingle together. From that first day until this day, that girl with eyes dark and wide keeps crying, lotus-eyed one. She weeps, she fades. She grieves all day long, her face alarmed, tears splashing, crying, jewel-colored one. So even the trees pity her. Ever since she learned the name of that city, all she does is join her hands in worship and say, Tirutolai Vilimangalam, home of the one who split the horse's mouth, which is Krishna, who killed a demon in the form of a horse and split his mouth and killed him in that way. Is she Pinai born here, or Nila, or the lady? What marvel is this? She stands calling, my tall lord, to hear that name of that town, to bow before Tirutolai Vilimangalam, where he who came before stands, sits, and dwells. That is her only thought. In thought, in word, and deed, Shatakopan of splendid Kurukur reached the point of calling the Lord of the gods his mother and father. Whoever masters these 10 pure Tamil verses about Tirutolai Vilimangalam from his venerable 1,000 verses will serve Tirumal, will serve Vishnu. And so Shatakopan is the name of Namalvar. Now, so you get this, the story here is you have this group of pilgrims that went to Tirutolai Vilimangalam, to this place, this Vaishnava temple, and there's a group of women that went there, and one of those women, something happened to her. She became fully sort of captured by the beauty of Vishnu that she saw there, and she, as the poet Namalvar kind of constantly addresses the women she's traveled with, and says, there's no hope for her anymore. She's lost to you. She will not go back with you to the village where, or the town or the city where you came from, but she will remain here and just worship Vishnu here in this shrine, because that's the only thing she can think of now. But one of the things that this poem particularly well illustrates is a distinction that Friedhelm Hardy made between two forms of bhakti. And this is in a book, a very influential book called Viraha Bhakti, which is a study of the Alvars, the poetry of the Alvars, the bhakti of Viraha, of separation, which we get here in this poem very, very beautifully, where she's crying out for Vishnu. She feels that separation from Vishnu and only wants to be reunited with Vishnu. And so Fred Hardy, what he posited, or what he argued, was that there's two forms of bhakti that we can distinguish. One he calls intellectual, and the other he calls emotional. And he says, he argues the intellectual form of bhakti is the bhakti that we find, for example, in a text like the Bhagavad Gita, where the focus or the way bhakti is expressed is by turning within. It's a form of meditation on God, where you gradually withdraw from the senses, you focus on God within, and it's kind of a fairly intellectual practice. It involves the study of sacred texts. It involves the use of your intellect to discriminate between matter and spirit, and so on. It's grounded in theological awareness of the supremacy of God, and so on. But he contrasts that with an emotional bhakti, which we find in the poetry of the Alvars, for example. And it's a bhakti that doesn't express itself in sort of the intellectual bhakti is a bhakti that will lead to self-control, control of your passions, control of your mind, control of your sensory faculties. And it will lead, as Krishna in the second chapter of the Gita talks about, it leads to an equanimity of mind, to a stillness of the mind, a freedom from desires, and so on. Whereas the emotional bhakti, Fred Hardy argued, as the sort of bhakti we see here in these poems, which is a devotion that expresses itself not through equanimity and peacefulness and so on, but rather through the intensity of emotions. And if you look, I mean, if you read the poem, the woman that Namalvar is describing here is anything but peaceful. She's crying, she's wailing, she's lamenting, she's longing for the Vishnu who's there in the temple. She breaks, she falls apart. And so emotionally, you know, you could say she's a mess. You know, she's all over the place with her emotions. But as Namalvar kind of praises her here, is she's beyond all the other women. All the other women have come to the temple out of devotional reasons and are worshipping Vishnu there in the temple, but now it's time for them to go back. But she's beyond them. She has reached an intensity of devotional absorption that is beyond them, but that expresses itself through these very vivid emotions. And so it's not a devotion that makes you turn within, but it's rather a devotion that makes you sort of turn without, you know, sort of makes you turn outwards. It's a devotion that's so intense that it cannot be contained in the body, and so it sort of erupts into tears, it erupts into fainting and so on, as she's described here. And Fred Hardy, who's in his book Viraha Bhakti, is studying the poetry of the Alvars, including Namalvar, kind of shows that this is the sort of bhakti that the Alvars particularly teach. It's a devotion where you can relate to Vishnu in the case of the Alvars, in the way that you relate to other persons in this world with the same emotional intensity. You can relate to Vishnu like a lover, you can relate to Krishna to Vishnu as a friend. You can relate. You can have enormous joy. You can have trepidation. You can have sort of anxiety. You can have sorrow and so on. All experienced in relation to the object of your devotion, and it's a it's remarkable in a sense to find this in the poetry of the Alvars, which then get incorporated into Sri Vaishnavism, as we've seen in the tradition of Ramanuja, because Ramanuja doesn't teach that sort of devotion. Ramanuja teaches more an intellectual devotion. It's sort of a there's a strong emphasis on self-control, on controlling the passions, and so on. Even though this is a sort of form of devotion that we find here, and it's the emotional form of bhakti that really comes to flourish in relation to Krishna devotion, which we'll talk about today. And so it's particularly in the development of Krishna devotion that emerges in the north of India from the 15th century onwards that we see this emotional bhakti coming to its full fruition, as it were, or sort of its furthest development. Not so much in sort of the expression in poetry, because we find that there in the Alvars already, but rather in theology. What we'll see is that the traditions that emerge in the north of India that focus on the worship of Krishna are going to develop a very sophisticated and elaborate theology, not just of the nature of God, but specifically of the nature of bhakti itself, the nature of devotion. And this is, in a sense, something new, where the focus becomes on the way you can approach God through devotion that is infused with all these emotions, that has that intensity of these emotions, and which means it's a devotion that comes to relate to God, which for them is Krishna, not as sort of the sort of in sort of the very Vedantic terms that we've seen so far in the Vaishnava traditions as sort of the Lord who is within the heart, the sort of the support of all existence, the only independent reality on which everything is dependent. They would argue, yes, Krishna is all these things, but more important than that in the practice of devotion is you can come to see Krishna not as God, but as your friend, or as your child, or as your lover. And so it's in these sort of relationships of that emotion that have these emotional intensities of wanting to protect Krishna because you consider him to be your child, or wanting to sort of having a friendly, boisterous sort of relationship with Krishna as Krishna's friends had when he descended in on this earth in northern India, in Vrindavan, or as your lover, where you see yourself as feminine, whatever your current gender is, but you see yourself as feminine in relation to Krishna, and you can worship Krishna as a lover. Which means that in these traditions, the two traditions we'll look at today, it means that they will argue, yes, God is all the things that the earlier Vaishnava theologians have said. But in the practice of devotion, you have to come to a point, or in the practice of this emotional form of devotion, you have to come to a point where you forget that the object of your worship is divine. And where you worship Krishna, not because he is God, but because he's the most wonderful person that exists. And so you cannot worship God, they would argue, as a lover, sort of relates to her lover, if you continue to see Krishna as God. So you kind of go beyond that. And as the tradition of Chaitanya, one of the traditions we'll look at, puts it, he said we have two aspects of the divine. We have the Aishwarya, the sovereignty, the sort of the majesty of God, and this is related to Ishvara, which literally means God. Ishvara. But then we have the Madhurya, the sweetness, the charm, the beauty of Krishna, of God. And the intellectual form of devotion, it's kind of as we will see, the distinction between those two forms of devotion that Fred Hardy kind of argued is a distinction the theologians of these schools themselves make in a way. They use different terminology for it, but it's a distinction they're aware of, where they look back on older traditions and say, these are traditions, the ones we have looked at so far, who emphasize the Aishwarya, the sovereignty, the majesty of God, where to have devotion to God is to become aware of the extraordinary nature of God, of the God who cannot be comprehended by any living being because he's so enormous, God who sort of inspires to some degree some sort of element of fear, some awe that manifests. Whereas they will see, the traditions we'll talk about today argue that what they say is that we focus on the Madhurya, we focus on the sweetness of God, which is fully manifested, not in the sort of the regal, the majestic Vishnu, but rather in Krishna, who is here for these traditions, is not seen as an avatar of Vishnu, but is seen as the supreme divinity itself, of which Vishnu is an avatar. And Krishna, who descended in this world at the end of the Dwapara age, at the end of the age before this age, and appeared in a pastoral setting, appeared in a hamlet of cowherd men and women called Vrindavan. Where he showed his divinity in various ways. He killed various demons. He lifted a mountain and so on. But really, the uniqueness about that descent, they argue, is not the sort of the superhuman things he did, but rather the way he attracted everyone to him, the way he attracted everyone in devotion through him, and became himself. Sort of lost his sense of divinity almost, and himself related to them as their child, as their lover, as their friend, and so on. And so these traditions that we will look at argue that the madhurya, the sweetness that is predominates in Krishna, does not sort of do away with the Aishwarya, with the sort of the godness of God, but rather overpowers this. And so this becomes in the background. The nature of Krishna as God sort of recedes in the background, and the sweetness comes forward. And so it's a devotion, they argue, that allows for much greater intimacy, that allows for a total abandonment of yourself in the devotion to Krishna, because you're not even worshipping God because he's God. You're worshipping God just purely because that is where your emotions lead you to. And that becomes the most important part of their understanding of bhakti, of devotion. Now, the... the two traditions we'll be talking about are two traditions that start independently of each other, but then do kind of develop in a crucial part, an early part of their development, alongside each other on friendly terms, and then sort of diverge and move away from each other for various reasons. But that is the tradition of Chaitanya, who is in Bengal, or he was born in Bengal, but then moved to Orissa. Just sort of on the, so if you have the Indian subcontinent, Sri Lanka here, so he's born here, and then spent most of his life a little further south on the coast. And a person called Vallabha, who is from Andhra, so he's from somewhere here, but settles first in Kashi, in Benares, and then moves to Vrindavan, which is about 4 hours southeast of Delhi, and or kind of Braj, kind of that area, and where principal disciples of Chaitanya are also present. Now, in a sense, that the two figures are very similar. Both of them worship Krishna. Both of them see Krishna as the supreme manifestation of divinity, of whom all the avatars are sort of, you know, who descend in all the avatars, including Vishnu. Both of them, for their textual focus on, for their textual their primary text is a text we've seen last term called the Bhagavata Purana. Which is a Puranic text, and it's the most sophisticated of all the Puranas. It's a text that that is very Krishna-centered. In the very beginning of the book, it sort of fairly unambiguously states that it gives a long list of all the avatars, and then the final verse you get is it says, all these forms that are worshipped in other Vaishnava traditions, he says, all of these are just parts of the divine, but Krishna is the Lord himself, and so Krishna is the supreme. It's a book that in a great length describes the life of Krishna and the devotion to Krishna. But it's also, unlike most of the other Puranas, it's a Purana that's enormously sophisticated in its theology, and that very consciously draws on Vedanta thought. And so it's from the very opening of the text, the first three words of the text, or the second sutra of the Brahma Sutra, the foundational text for Vedanta. And throughout the text, you find all these echoes with Vedanta ideas in there, to such an extent that both the tradition of Vallabha and both and Chaitanya argue that this text, this narrative text, that has a lot of theological digressions, but essentially is a narrative text, is the commentary on the Brahma Sutras itself. And so they say, this is really, if you want to engage in Vedanta, like most Vaishnava traditions want to do, this is the text to go to, because this is the commentary on Vedanta. And the Puranas are traditionally ascribed to Vyasa, and the Bhagavata itself makes a big deal about this. In the beginning, there's a whole discussion on Vyasa as the author of the text and how the text came to be. And the Bhagavata in the beginning tells that Vyasa has just divided the one Veda into four. He's composed the Mahabharata, he's written the Puranas, and so on, and he feels dissatisfied. And he wonders, why I've done such a great service to humanity, I've done such a great work, why do I feel dissatisfied? And then his guru arrives, the sage Narada, and Narada says, the reason you are dissatisfied is because in everything you've described so far, you've given hints of Krishna, but you've not talked about Krishna openly. So do this now, and then you will find that satisfaction that you're longing for. And so the Bhagavata says that is how the Bhagavata came to be, that's how the text came to be. But it's then, because Vyasa is also the author of the Brahma Sutras, traditionally he's also seen as the author of that, this then is seen as the commentary on the Brahma Sutras by the author of the Brahma Sutras, and so it's given that special status. And so followers of both traditions will write very lengthy commentaries on the Bhagavata, elaborating on the theology, drawing on the theology. And when they're not writing commentaries on the Bhagavata, they'll write theological treatises that are basically entirely based on the Bhagavata, that are attempting to establish the theology of the Bhagavata. And so there's a real shift from kind of classical Vedanta to sort of what you could call Puranic Vedanta. It's Vedanta that is infused with Puranic narratives, with Puranic ideas, with devotion to Krishna, and that's in a sense kind of a Vedanta that leads away from Vedanta. It's a Vedanta that that engages with the same issues that earlier Vedantists have engaged with, but in order to lead away from the sort of the focus of Vedanta, which leads to a conception of the Aishwarya, the majesty of God, to the Madhurya, to the sweetness of God, which sort of knowing the sort of classical Vedanta gives you a greater understanding of the importance of this. And so it's not that Krishna doesn't have this, but this overpowers it, and it's because he has this that this becomes more significant. That's the way they conceive of it. And so there's a real shift that takes place in kind of from the Vaishnava tradition that we've seen so far, from Ramanuja and Madhva, for example. Madhva himself wrote a commentary on the Bhagavata, and there is the main image he established in the temple is an image of Krishna. And the Chaitanya tradition actually aligns itself in some ways with the tradition of Madhva, although as we'll see theologically they're really at odds with each other. But it kind of comes to a real focus here, and sort of slightly moving away from Vedanta. Vallabha does write a commentary on the Brahma Sutras as well, a very lengthy commentary that his son finished. He sort of passed away before it was completed. But it's really his commentary on the Bhagavata that's the most prominent text for him. Yes. Okay. Let's see. Now, just to give you a little sense of the distinctness of both traditions. Let's look at them individually for a moment. Chaitanya was a Brahmin who was born in a place called Navadvip, which is a place in Bengal, a few hours north of Calcutta, which at the time was a very important center of Nyaya, of logic. And it was kind of an intellectual hothouse where people from all over India would come to study. And he's born there in a Brahmin family. He himself starts his own school. He teaches Sanskrit grammar mostly there. And he's married. His first wife passes away. He marries again. and he sort of, you know, has a very promising career, all the hagiographies say. He was a great scholar, a very brilliant mind, until he goes on pilgrimage to Gaya in Bihar to perform the funerary rites, or so the ancestor rites, for his father who had passed away. And so it's kind of, Gaya is the place where, so it's traditionally associated with funerary rites. So he goes there, and while he's there, he meets a sannyasi, an ascetic, called Ishwarapuri, who is from Bengal, but is you know, is an ascetic, so he's wandering around. He gets initiated by Ishwarapuri, comes back to Bengal, transformed, and to the great surprise of his students, his grammar students, he doesn't teach grammar anymore, but the only thing he does is talk about Krishna. Soon his students leave him. He sort of meets the local Vaishnava community of Navadvip, and together with them, they meet in the house of one of his principal disciples every night to have kirtan, to have singing of the names of Krishna. This becomes the central practice for the Chaitanya tradition, to gather together and in, you know, musically reciting the names of Krishna. And only 2 years after sort of his devotional awakening, Chaitanya decides to renounce the world. He becomes a sannyasi and decides to go to Vrindavan in Uttar Pradesh, the place of Krishna's childhood, and spent the rest of his life there. But his mother, who's, you know, her husband passed away already, she had all her sons except Chaitanya had either died in were stillborn, or one of them, she had one son that lived, but he also became a sannyasi. And so she requests Chaitanya. She says, "Well, I know as a sannyasi you cannot be sort of here anymore, but at least stay close by so I can still get some news from you from time to time." So he moves south to Orissa, to the to a place called Puri, where there's a temple of Jagannath, a Vaishnava temple, and a strong sort of political Hindu kingdom there. And he settles there, and apart from a few trips elsewhere, he spends the rest of his life there. And while he sends disciples of his to Vrindavan to develop that place as a place of pilgrimage. And so the tradition really develops in three places: in Bengal, in Orissa, and in Vrindavan, in sort of central North India. And really, it's kind of, the tradition is influenced by sort of the cultures of all three places. The interesting about Chaitanya actually is that he's kind of bhakti is sort of generally in the popular imagination these days is sort of associated, mostly because of the influence of the sants that we talked about last week, with low caste groups and so on, as being a practice, you know, that's sort of open to the masses and so on. And the Chaitanya tradition has that side to it as well. And there are a few of Chaitanya's associates are kind of these charismatic individuals who convert the particularly low caste individuals to the Vaishnava practices that they're teaching. But the sort of Vaishnavism that Chaitanya is developing is of a very different type, and we'll see Vallabha as well in many respects. And it's a highly Sanskritic Vaishnavism. It's a Vaishnavism that grounds itself partly in the language of sort of the vernacular language, the language of the people, but also establishes this very rich and very sophisticated and difficult Sanskrit literature that is inaccessible to those who don't have a training in classical Sanskrit education. And you see this too in with Chaitanya, particularly in the sort of people that he attracts. Two of his most prominent disciples are a person called Rupa and Sanatana, which are the names Chaitanya gives them, who were working at the court of the Sultan of Bengal, exactly what their positions were are unclear, and the hagiographies kind of are fairly vague on it. But it seems Rupa was the the private secretary of the Sultan himself. Bengal was ruled at that time by the Muslim regime. They were Brahmins, but they worked for the Mughal court, and Sanatan was some sort of minister at the court. They renounced their position at the court upon meeting Chaitanya, and Chaitanya then sends them to Vrindavan, where they become the leaders of the community there. And similarly, when he moves to Puri in Orissa, one of his principal disciples there is a person called Ramananda Rai, who was the governor of parts of the state. And so there's kind of, you know, really powerful political individuals involved that, as we'll see in a moment, has important implications for the way the tradition develops. Chaitanya himself does not write anything. There's 8 verses that are ascribed to him, but apart from that, they're sort of devotional expressions. Apart from that, he didn't write anything, and it's his disciples that really elaborate on the theology that they say they have received from Chaitanya, produce quite a lot of literature, and it's quite impressive, sort of in a few years, just the enormous amount of literature that is produced and the range of literature that they produce. It goes from commentaries on the Bhagavata to just independent treatises on theology, to treatises on the nature of bhakti, to dramas and poetry and songs, and as well as in the vernacular then in Bengali, works that tell the life of Chaitanya. And within sort of 60 years, there's you know, it's almost every decade there's a hagiography of Chaitanya that's produced in the tradition. In a sense, sort of all these hagiographies sort of function as a way of kind of binding the community sort of around the figure of Chaitanya and his prominent disciples, because the tradition doesn't have a central authority. It's kind of, you get charismatic and sort of disciples of Chaitanya who each themselves gather disciples around them, and each of those groups writes their own account of the life of Chaitanya that sort of includes the person around whom they're gathering, Chaitanya's disciple that they're following. But anyway, that's kind of developing there. But it's really for the theology, it's these two individuals, Rupa and Sanatan, and their nephew, Jiva. So Rupa and Sanatan were brothers, then there was a third brother in the family who passed away, who met Chaitanya but then passed away, and his son is a person called Jiva. And it's those three in particular that really established the theology of the school and in Sanskrit treatises. And central to them is the Bhagavata Purana. Sanatana writes a commentary on the Bhagavata Purana, as well as a narrative text, a sort of Puranic text of its own that he calls the Bhagavatamrita, the essence of the Bhagavata, which is a long narration about, you know, the way Krishna bestows his grace upon various devotees. Rupa writes another Bhagavatamrita, another essence of the Bhagavata, which is a theological treatise establishing the different ways in which Krishna manifests himself. And Jiva writes a 6-volume work called the Bhagavata Sandarbhas, the treatises on the Bhagavata. And so the Bhagavata is central for all of them, and it's there that they derive their theology from. But one of the interesting things that they're doing in the light of earlier Vaishnava traditions that we've seen is that they're engaging with these authors, and like Jiva cites Ramanuja and cites Madhva and cites Shankara in his writings, and is very well aware of the history of Vedanta. But as we've seen, kind of one of the key issues in the debate between Vaishnava and Advaita Vedanta was about the nature of God. Is Brahman nirvishesha, without any attributes, or is Brahman savishesha? Does he have attributes? And so the Ramanuja and Madhva argued that, well, Brahman is Vishnu, has an ocean of unlimited qualities. And Shankara argues, no, Brahman has no attributes. We, you know, the only thing we can say about Brahman is what it is not. And that's kind of the contentious issue between the two traditions. And the Advaitins are arguing the Vaishnavas are wrong in their understanding, and the Vaishnavas are arguing the Advaitins are wrong in their understanding of it. But what we see happening here is something we've seen to some degree already with the Sant, but becomes particularly prominent in this period, not just with these two traditions, but sort of throughout the subcontinent, is a greater degree of inclusivism. What Jiva in particular is arguing is that the Advaitins' understanding of Brahman is not wrong, but it is incomplete. And so it's a real shift in the way they engage with Advaita Vedanta. And you'll find a lot of the rhetoric against the Advaitins is the same, but theologically they take a very different position. And this is based on a verse from the Bhagavata, where they argue God has three aspects. We have Bhagavan, let's start with the Brahman. The Bhagavata in the very beginning, it says that there is a non-dual truth, which is pure perception, and that is known by these three terms. And they're terms that are found throughout Hindu texts. And earlier commentators on the Bhagavata just take, basically interpret the verse as saying, and, these are the different names that are given to that non-dual reality, and full stop. What is important for someone like Jiva is he will argue, he says, no, this is a hierarchy, what it says. And first, the Bhagavata says it's Brahman. And Brahman is essentially what the Advaitins claim Brahman is. Brahman is nirvishesha. It has no attributes. It is pure existence. It is pure consciousness. And that is it. There is no variegatedness in this. And so this is a notion that we've seen, like Madhva and Ramanuja arguing that notion, the Advaitin notion of Brahman is just logically incoherent. It is not something the Upanishads establish and so on. Here, they're starting to say, no, this is fine. This is what the Advaitins know. But higher than this is the Paramatma, literally the Supreme Self, which is God in relation to his creation, is God who dwells within every single particle of matter, within the individual self. It is God sort of who's immanent in this world. Here you have variegatedness. There are attributes. God is the creator, God is the sustainer, and so on. So there are qualities that one can ascribe to God. But finally, the fullest manifestation of divinity is in Bhagavan, which means sort of the personal deity, and that is identified in the Bhagavata with Krishna. It's in a sense, the way to make sense of this, you have to work from the top down. They say, Bhagavan, Krishna, is God who manifests all his attributes. The fullness of God is revealed in that. The way they're thinking about it actually is in terms of Shakti, in terms of powers. All the qualities of God, Rupa and Jiva argue, are powers of God. Or Shaktis. And so when they're fully manifested, we're talking about Bhagavan, about Krishna, about the full manifestation of divinity. When God suppresses some of his Shakti, or does not reveal some of his powers, but only reveals those in relation to creation, then you have this understanding of Paramatma. When God suppresses all his Shaktis, all his powers, and does not reveal any of them, then you're here. And so basically what they're saying is the Advaitins, what they're understanding is the same non-dual reality, because these are all one, because it's the same being that you're perceiving. But they're perceiving it in a limited way, in sort of an incomplete way. And we'll see in Vallabha has a similar argument where he argues that there's two realities. We have Bhagavan or Krishna, and then we have what he calls Akshara Brahman. Akshara means fallible, which is the world. Is Akshara is fallible, and Akshara Brahman is is the infallible Brahman. It's the source of this creation. It's not exactly the same as Brahman with the followers of Chaitanya, but it's sort of a similar understanding that this, they argue, Vallabha argues, the Akshara Brahman is non-dual, is non-different from the fullest manifestation of divinity. But whereas this can only be attained through bhakti, through devotion, and particularly the devotion that he's teaching, this, the Akshara Brahman, can only be attained through jnana, through the meditative knowledge and the gnosis that the Advaitins teach. And so again, you see sort of this greater inclusion, this sort of attempt to sort of say, okay, here you have these Advaitins who for centuries have been the rivals of the Vaishnavas, and they're sort of, they still remain the rivals, and they don't have many great things to say about the Advaitins. But theologically, there's a greater inclusivism, kind of pulling them in and saying, okay, yes, this is part of the bigger picture, but it's only incomplete. This is the realm of bhakti. So God in his fullness can only be known through bhakti. It's only through a relationship of love that God reveals his true nature to you. The others can only be approached, if you approach, whether it's Akshara Brahman, or if you approach God through any other means, you can only realize Akshara Brahman or Brahman or Paramatma, and nothing further than that. But even in their understanding of theology, of the nature of bhakti, then there's also a real shift that takes place with the earlier traditions. And this is a distinction that is made between two forms of bhakti, which in a sense correspond to some degree between the two. It's not entirely the same, but there's some parallels with Hardy's typology. And in the Chaitanya tradition, they're called Vaidhi and Raga Yoga. And the Vallabha system is called Maryada and Pushti. Oops, Pushti, Maryada. And it's basically, as I said, you know, the two traditions kind of start separately, but then kind of in a crucial period of their theological development are existing alongside each other. And that is when Rupa and Sanatan and Jiva are present in Vrindavan. Vallabha, who sort of moved around for part of his life, comes to settle basically across the river. Across the river from Vrindavan is a settlement called Gokul, which is associated with Krishna's childhood. And Vallabha settles there, and Vallabha and Rupa and Sanatan spend a lot of time together. They read the Bhagavata together, and they refer to each other in their writings. And it's the typology of this, of these two. This is Rupa's typology, and this is Vallabha's. But in Rupa's work, he says, what I'm calling Vaidhi and Raganuga, others, meaning Vallabha, called Maryada and Pushti Marga. And basically what it is they're both forms of bhakti, but Vaidhi, in the way Rupa talks about it, is derived from the word vidhi, which means injunction. And it's bhakti that is motivated by the injunctions of scripture. So you worship Krishna in the way that scripture tells you should worship Krishna. And so you follow the Pancharatra text for the worship of Krishna in the temple. You follow various texts like the Bhagavata who talk about the way sort of the practice should be structured and so on. And Maryada in Vallabha's terminology means sort of boundaries, the limits. And so it's the same idea. It's sort of a bhakti that's pursued within certain sort of parameters, within certain boundaries that are laid down by scripture and so on. And so this is kind of the bhakti that is known in earlier traditions, earlier Vaishnava traditions. It's the form of bhakti that Ramanuja talks about and so on. But they contrast this with another practice which is in Rupa's terminology is raganuga, is anuga, is following raga or passion, and so it's sometimes somewhat clunkily perhaps translated as passion pursuant. It follows the motivation to practice this does not come from the injunctions of scripture, but rather from raga, from intense passion that is developed towards Krishna. Rupa says when you hear the anything related to Krishna and your mind just runs with it, and your mind just, you know, you have no control over it, you're just moved spontaneously to devotion to Krishna, that is what is understood in Raganuga. And it's a practice where you start to meditate on your relationship with Krishna as a friend, as a lover, as a parent, and so on. And it's kind of through, you still engage in the practices of Vaidhi, you still worship Krishna in the temple and so on, but it's sort of infused with that the intensity of the emotions that comes from thinking of Krishna in one of those relationships. Vallabha calls it the Pushti Marga, the path, which is the term that his tradition is often known by. They themselves called themselves the Pushti Marga, the path of Pushti, literally nourishment, but they understand nourishment to be grace. So it's the path of grace. But it's quite similar in to Rupa's understanding. It's the path of grace where Krishna sort of allows others to relate to him as friend, as lover, as parent, and so on, through his grace, and through that you are nourished, and that becomes the motivation for your practice, not the maryada, not the boundaries established by scripture and so on, but rather the freedom that comes from emotional involvement in the divine, this is what they're saying. They're teaching, and they're kind of drawing on these things. They're sort of incorporating the practices from these into their. They're both traditions that are very, actually very established temple traditions, and so which is kind of falls within this. But this becomes an aspect of this is sort of expressed through the emotional intensity of raga or pushti of grace, and that sort of sets them apart. Okay, very briefly then. Vallabha, as I said, kind of moves to the region where Rupa and Sanatan, where Chaitanya's disciples are kind of developing the theology of their own tradition. And as some scholars of Vallabha have argued, if it was only Vallabha, we wouldn't speak of a tradition of Pushti Marga. We would just have this individual Brahmin scholar who would write text, and that would be sort of the end of it. But it's his son that really turns Vallabha's teachings into a system and into a tradition. And his son is called Vitalnath, who tradition sees to be Krishna himself, who is descended, just as Chaitanya is seen by his disciples to be both Radha and Krishna, both Krishna and Radha and his beloved united in one form. And Vitalnath is also someone who was on friendly terms with the disciples of Chaitanya, but it's really he who establishes the tradition and sort of develops this and organizes it. And he had, it's his sons, he had how many sons? Seven sons, if I remember correctly. Seven. Seven sons. And it's his seven sons then that, however many there are, it's his seven sons that lead to what they call the gaudis, the houses of the Pushti Marga, of the tradition, where it's basically the gurus in the Pushti Marga tradition are all descendants of Vitalnath through one of those seven houses, those seven family lineages. which are all householder lineages. I mean, it goes from father to son. It's sort of passed down. whereas Chaitanya's tradition, as I mentioned, is less organized in that sense. It's just individuals who, disciples of Chaitanya, who get their own disciples, and it's sort of more, kind of less centralized in a sense, or less organized than the tradition of Vallabha. But you kind of see a big difference between the two traditions in their organization, where here, this is all householders. Vallabha himself was married and had another son as well. Then Vitalnath has seven sons, and they start their families and so on. And there's a strong emphasis on grihastha, on family life. Vallabha himself argued that sannyas, the act of renunciation, is not sort of very conducive for bhakti, because it will lead to pride and so on, whereas bhakti is grounded in humility. And so he said, you know, his followers up until this day look down on ascetic life, whereas Rupa and Sanatan and Jiva, they're all ascetics, and Chaitanya himself became an ascetic. And it's a tradition that's, you know, predominantly householders, but very influential ascetic communities within it that function as gurus, as teachers, and so on. So that's one of the big differences between them. Just as a final note, the traditions kind of, in these two generations, the traditions sort of cooperate, sort of exist peacefully alongside each other, and it's kind of towards the end of Jiva's life, things sort of start to fall apart, and the two traditions fall out with each other and start taking each other to court and so on, to the Mughal court, and we have those legal documents, very sort of colorful, of accusing each other, people from each other's tradition, of stealing money from their temples. And partly what happens is, in this period, in Vrindavan, which is not too far from Agra and Fatehpur Sikri, which are the seats of the Mughal Empire, they get patronage, and they get patronage, particularly the tradition of Chaitanya, gets patronage from the highest sources, basically. Akbar himself established, grants tax cuts and land, and becomes a patron of some temples in Vrindavan. But it's particularly Akbar's general, a person called Man Singh, who is basically adopted by Akbar as his own son. He becomes a patron of Rupa's temple, it's still, if you're ever in the area, the temple that Man Singh built is still there in Vrindavan. Part of it is demolished, but it's one of the most spectacular pieces of architecture that sort of blends Rajasthani Mughal architecture and sort of Hindu, traditional Hindu forms of architecture. And it's with that sort of patronage that you get politics that really come in, and they're starting to compete over money and temple and land and so on. And the traditions sort of split. The Chaitanya tradition sort of stays in sort of the Vrindavan area, as well as Puri and Orissa and Bengal. But then by the 17th century moves to Rajasthan. The tradition of Vallabha continues to develop in the Braj area, in the Vrindavan area, but then moves further west to Gujarat and Rajasthan. And so they kind of geographically also drift apart from each other. So anyway, that's in a brief nutshell, something on Krishna devotion.